Here we go.
Hi, everybody, and welcome in to the world-famous BP Wrigley Cast. I am your longtime host, Carlos. All right, no, I'm not Carlos, but I am indeed Matt Spiegel, and I've hosted this for years. God, it's always been such a pleasure. And I'm honored to welcome this time Isaac and Joel and Ryan. So, Ryan, why don't you, involve yourself in my show?
Yes, absolutely.
In your world.
Thank you, Carlos. We thought it would be fun that because Carlos couldn't be with us to completely big time him and bring in someone awesome. Thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about the Cubs.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you talk to Joe Maddon once a week. Is that correct on your show?
That is correct. Going on year two of talking to him Tuesdays at noon usually. Some of those have been in person, which is always better.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize that.
Oh, that is really cool. So from your knowledge of having spoken to Joe Maddon fairly frequently, I've been running with this theory a bit lately, and I want to hear what you think about it.
Okay.
There's a lot of fan angst over the way he's utilized the bullpen with the injuries lately, bringing in guys like Joe Smith in a fairly large leverage situation. I think that Joe Maddon has been utilizing the roster in a very different way because of the 12-game lead in the division, whereas with three games over the Cardinals, let's say, he might not be doing it that way. I think fans have a short memory and don't remember last season when he kind of abused Travis Wood and Pedro Strop and Hector Rondon down the stretch. Do you think Joe Maddon has been doing the bullpen a little bit differently, giving those guys at the back end who are Joe Smith better leverage situations to see what they have? Because I think there's a lot of fans who think, how could this team possibly win in the playoffs if we're pitching Joe Smith in the eighth inning?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's something that he would never say publicly, but it's something that you can definitely glean both from watching and from talking to him. I think the moment in game when I realized it was when he let Carl Edwards Jr. hang out there in crucial situations and pitch to Trout and Pujols with first base open. Remember that against the Angels a couple of weeks ago?
Definitely.
And there's certain moments. I mean, look, even with losing two out of three in Colorado, what are they, 33 games over 500 as it stands today, and learning exactly what he has and what he's going to use and when he's going to be able to use them is far more important than winning a game here or there. And again, that's not something I'll ever say publicly. But when we've talked bullpen before, he knows that he's going to need like four guys that he can trust with the lead. And those might be fairly obvious if everybody's healthy. That'll be Chapman, Rondon, Strop, and maybe Grimm and or Wood. So that's five guys there. But, you know, he thinks of Grimm as one of his lefties because of that curveball, you know.
Yeah.
But he's going to have a very limited palate. And as you say, last year in games – in the games that mattered, he used that very limited bunch. So he's got this absurd opportunity to check everybody out and throw Rondon and Lackey on the DL just cause, you know, and get spot starts out of Mike Montgomery and Trevor Cahill that are incredibly useful. And the organizational goal all along has been to be healthy and know exactly what you have in your back pocket by October. And that's definitely his number one. So I agree with your theory.
Who would have thought that the only game they would have won in Colorado would be the Mike Montgomery Trevor Cahill game?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah,
crazy.
Hey Matt, listen, I wanted to ask you. I don't want to reopen the Chapman can of worms because I know we've all talked about that quite a bit. But I'm curious about your thoughts on the team chemistry. And you know, we kind of look at this team as like the greatest bunch of guys, and gee, wouldn't it be awesome to hang out with Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant because they're so super cool and nice and everything. But I'm wondering, like, A, how close is that perception to the reality? You're closer to the team than we are. And B, how important is that in general? I mean, I want to say that maybe you're familiar with the cliche. We see that the Yankees or the A's from the mid-70s and so on refer to it as 25 limos for 25 guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it's just talent. Chemistry doesn't mean anything, you know. So I wonder your take in that discussion of chemistry versus talent, and
well,
how important is that?
I got you. Well, specifically when it comes to this team, Lester and Ross run that clubhouse.
Interesting.
And as soon as they came in, they took over. And that's just, I've heard that from guys off the record, from guys on the record. And that's just how strong the personalities are. And then Lackey now is Lester's boy. And then Ross, you know, Rizzo is now Ross's boy. And Rizzo is learning from Ross how to be what Ross is, you know? And and Ross is just one of those intense personalities who's just up all the time. He's in everybody's face all the time. You can't avoid him. And you love him until you hate him, and then you realize you still loved him when he's gone. He himself says he's a short-term relationship guy when it comes to teams. After a couple years, are kind of done with him. But those guys totally took over. And the thing that's so strong is that, you know, Rizzo got so completely aligned with them. Bryant is a totally quiet, you know, peaceful, easygoing dude. Arrieta is strong, obviously, but, you know, Lester has rings. Lester's got rings, and Ross has a ring, and Madden trusts those guys to do their thing. And it's obviously strong enough to withstand, you know, I mean, Chapman, the issues with Chapman are not him as a teammate, you know.
We've
never really heard of him as a bad teammate.
Right.
And then you've got the language barrier, which precludes a certain amount of communication and coexistence anyway. And then you've got the limited time here on a rental and the bigger mission that he's being brought into. So there wasn't a lot of risk in terms of chemistry for that thing. And to your broader point, yeah, you know, I'm one of those guys who thoroughly believes that if you're happy and, you know, you're under control and you're at peace with yourself and you're getting along with everybody, that you're going to be able to perform at a higher level. I believe that in everything that I've ever done. And the people that I've talked a lot of baseball with, a lot of them believe it. Madden believes that. Theo believes that. You know, Theo gets painted as a numbers wonk, but I think you guys know how much they care about makeup, how much they care about personal makeup and personal strength, and they scout that. Jason McLeod scouts that. So it's about guys who are going to be able to deal with the ridiculous mental grind that is the game. And then if you got a bunch of those guys who are strong enough, then the chemistry part will kind of take care of itself. Where Madden comes into that is just as a communicator. He's a terrific communicator and a relentlessly positive guy who his players genuinely like. Even if they think he's a little cheesy, they still like him, you know. And so he has a good effect on the communication. But this team is blessed with Lester and Ross.
Interesting.
I want to follow up on something you said there that I think is a really good point, and that is, there, as far as clubhouse chemistry goes, what that means to the players in the clubhouse is how they interact within the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And I know that's unfortunate for a lot of fans who hear the words clubhouse chemistry and they see how fun and outgoing and personable a lot of these guys are, and they think, boy, it's just a whole bunch of good guys, and they think, well, Chapman's going to poison that clubhouse chemistry. Much as fans probably don't like it, and I think a lot of us don't like it, to those guys, a lot of them don't care about what happened outside the clubhouse. They care about what happens inside the clubhouse. I think that's a hard the message doesn't translate so well to fans who just can't quite grasp that. Do you feel like that's kind of the attitude coming from the Cubs about a guy like Chapman, is what they really care about is what he's going to do on the field and if he's going to be a good guy inside the clubhouse?
Absolutely. I think whether a guy is a good teammate or not matters far more than however many crimes or however many misdeeds they may have committed off the field. I mean, without a doubt. And it can be a pristine person who's just kind of a petty, selfish teammate, and that's not going to fly, unless, of course, they're great. in which case excuses got made for Bonds, excuses got made for Jim Rice back in the day, you know, excuses get made. I think that's absolutely true. And it was really interesting to kind of navigate the Chapman conversation, because the Chapman thing, at least momentarily and for some longer than others, sullied the clean good feelings, you know, to the fans. And I give that credence, because I've seen it, and I felt it for a few days there, and I still, it comes up every once in a while. But in terms of selling it for the players, nope, everybody's totally fine with that guy.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I think everybody on this podcast can relate with the sort of dirty feeling that you just spoke of. And it did seem to kind of sully everything that we had had and the purity that this team was. Perhaps that's naive, but I actually want to focus on you for a second, Matt. You spoke of a mental grind, and as a fan and an analyst, the only way that I can kind of describe the last 5 years is as a grind. So as a radio host that's doing this for hours upon hours every single day of your life, what has these last 2 years meant to you compared to the previous 5 years before that? And just what has it been like for you to follow a fun and a great team?
It's been remarkable. Can you hear me, by the way?
Totally.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Good. I thought I hit a button and I was an idiot, but I'm an idiot, but I didn't hit a button. It's been remarkable. The whole thing has been remarkable because, remember, like, I was doing Hit and Run, the Sunday morning baseball show with Barry Rosner for the last 2 years of the Jim Hendry regime. And the amount of conversations that we had where we would ask Cub fans, are you ready to commit to an overhaul and a rebuild and try to build something like, say, the Twins, mm-hmm. right? Or try to build something like what the Braves did years and years ago, or try to become more like the Cardinals as an organization. Yeah. And we would take fervent calls from people saying, yes, I'm ready. And then it happened. Mm-hmm. And you had the loud minority, I frankly do believe it was a minority, but very loud, who was saying, but I care about my time on the couch. And I was the guy telling them it's not about your time on the couch for 3 years, you know, and writing columns and talking about zooming out and widening the focus and look at the money in the Dominican, look at the money in the minor leagues and look at what they're doing and all that kind of stuff. And now to get it to pay off this quickly is absurd. It's an unfair model for any organization that tries to do this, you know? Obviously, regardless of whether they get to a World Series or win a World Series, they won 97 games in year four, and they're on pace to win over 100 in year five. It's been incredible to watch it play out. It's been amazing to watch just how patient Theo and Jed have to be along the way in the face of even, you know, smart guys getting impatient. You know, I not to cast myself as a smart guy, but how about somebody who understood the plan, right? I wanted to move Javi Baez. I openly admit that I was ready after seeing that first sample in the bigs. I was like, man, that swing is never going to catch up. Go get a young Mets pitcher. You're a perfect match. Go, come on, let's do this. And obviously I'm thrilled that they didn't do that kind of thing. Although I think they looked into it, but they just have to be relentlessly patient, and that's been so instructive to watch. I feel like I've learned so much about the game and organizations and really about you know, business theory and sports business theory over the last 5 years. Really, if you're paying attention, aren't we all so much smarter than we were 5 years ago?
Definitely, it's a great point.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Matt. And you know, it's you talked some about Theo, and you referred to him as a numbers wonk, I believe.
That some thought he was a numbers wonk. He was painted that way in these.
I mean, I think he's a fascinating blend of left and right brain. You know, and that's kind of what I want to get to next, because as you know, you've talked to people within the organization, and what I want to know is how has he? I mean, he's cracked the code. Like, how has he just hit again and again and again? I mean, Chris Bryant was kind of a no-brainer, but Kyle Schwarber, no one saw him as becoming what he's become. Like, what is his secret sauce for finding these players, A? And B, you can't help but be a little – I know pitchers develop more slowly, but I'm wondering why that hasn't quite translated to pitchers. I know that there's, you know, Underwood and Cease and guys that, you know, people are optimistic about, but I'm wondering, is there any pattern that you see that it's not quite carrying over to pitchers, or do you think that's just going to happen down the road?
That's a really fascinating question. Rob Zastrzyzny is the first guy they drafted to make it to the bigs, right? Okay. And even when you look at what happened in Boston, there were a few pitchers. I mean, Lester was a McLeod, Theo, Hoyer pick, and McLeod is connected to every single thing. McLeod is the scouting genius, I truly believe. And when you look at, you know, all those guys on the Red Sox, the Jackie Bradley Juniors and Xander Bogarts and. Yeah. I mean, all those guys they get credit as Theo guys, but they're McLeod guys, you know? And Theo eventually okays it. And Schwarber's a McLeod guy. I think there's one scout that they sent to Indiana games who said, oh, my God, you have to watch him. So everybody has shared that wisdom. Whatever their wisdom is on hitters is stunning, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I really think that a large part of the wisdom is – this guy will be able to change. And look at Rizzo. This guy will be able to adjust because of this personality, of how relaxed they are, how simple their mechanics are. Because really, how simple is Schwarber's setup and swing? And how simple is, you know, go look at Mookie Betts. How simple is that? And really, it's a matter of really simple, basic stuff, and then the makeup to adjust. And I always go back to Rizzo because they drafted him and then fell in love with him as he developed and got cancer and reacted to that. And then Jed traded for him in San Diego. And then as soon as they got here, they traded for him again because they knew that he would develop the BHAC. They knew that he would get – that he could have that two-strike approach and could become this guy. No matter what that first taste in San Diego was, they knew he had it in him to become this guy. So I guess mastering that for pitchers is a completely different science. And I haven't thought about it much because I really haven't thought about their methodology with pitchers other than to find healthy ones who've proven healthy and then pay them a bunch of money, you know, which may be a very wise way to do it, frankly. Find the ones who endure for whatever reason and throw the money at them.
Yeah, that you make a good point there about pitchers. I think you see a lot of other organizations. The Mets are a good example where they've had some injuries in their rotation. They built around pitchers the same way the Cubs built around hitters. And, I mean, the Cubs are back out mashing the ball and finding pitching. So there might be something to that. But the question I wanted to ask you is, you compared very briefly this to the Cardinals, the way the Cardinals built up and went on their run. And they started that back in 2000. And they didn't win the World Series until 2006. If it takes 6 years from last year, so let's say not this year, not next, not the one after, the 6 years of winning the division, getting into the playoffs to win the World Series, how do you think in the next 2 or 3 years things will change for you? Because you speak to the fans on a very direct basis, whereas we, you know, we write it and put it out there and we don't field calls, so we don't have to deal with that. How do you think that'll change for you?
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I've got to be patient in the face of the everyday in a different way. So you're right about that. By the way, when I was talking about the Cardinals, I was thinking about like the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, what they set up then in terms of a cohesion of scouting and having a way and having a book and having the same teaching principles all the way up and down. But anyway, back to your point, I think this is the way it actually came up last week. Last year was a bonus year in terms of the expectations of the masses. And that the fact that they beat the Cardinals in a series, oh my God, that was so much. That was enough for just about, 80%, 90% of the fan base, really?
Yeah.
I believe that this year the line is drawn at getting to the World Series because I think we all still know that it's a crapshoot. And obviously they could lose in a 5-game series in the first round. But if they get to the World Series this year and they get there for the first time, what is it, since 45? Is that right? Yeah. So they get there for the first time. I think people will be thrilled, and then they'll be upset if they lose. But every year thereafter is going to become a win it or bust thing. It is, and I think they've embraced that, and they know that, and you want that. It's once the Blackhawks broke through, if they don't get there and win it, that's a failure. You know, it's just the way it is in this town. And, you know, I think there were a lot of Braves fans and a lot of national baseball pundits who looked at that as, you know, we look back at it now and we're so impressed and we can intellectually say, man, they got like 15 straight bites of the apple or whatever they got. But they won once, and that felt like an underachievement then. It certainly did, you know, to a lot of Braves fans. So I think after this year, it's, you know, they're right now, they're right here in the middle of the window. They know it, and they're going for it aggressively right now. And that window exists for the next, 5-6 years, something like that. And I think every year the expectations are going to be the kind of expectations that got tiresome in Boston for those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how you say that with the window. I think we on the podcast here have kind of separated into two windows, one being this year and next year with Jake Arrieta and John Lackey on board, and then after that possibly with the free agent class of 2018 and seeing what starting pitching they can bring along and if they can trade for any controlled starting pitching. I'd like to hear from you again. You've spent about 75 hours, by my rough math, interviewing Joe Madden, the sage, wise Joe Madden. What impression has he left on you as a person, and what is maybe the biggest thing that you've learned from him?
He's so curious. He's just so passionately curious still, and he knows so much, but doesn't believe he knows it all. I mean, he's muscled up on me a couple of times when I challenged him on some things, and he's intellectually muscled up on me and said, "Well, were you thinking about this? Were you thinking about that? Were you thinking about this?" Just to show me that, like, you know, how dare you question me, you little man. But for the most part, he's got his eyes wide open, and he's curious, and he's looking for new stuff, and. You know, and that's in every sense. Guy's got four or five books next to his bed that he's reading constantly. He's looking for new bottles of wine to check out. He's there's been times off the air where I'll tell him stuff about my baseball past, and he's like, and I mean like baseball fan past or my family past or whatever. He's interested. He wants to know. He's a genuinely curious guy, which is a beautiful thing. And I think and that's the kind of thing that translates through osmosis, doesn't it, to your players? If they see you being curious and you being wide open, you being passionate, I think they're gonna realize that that's a good way to be. So I guess that's number one. And then just he's a go with his gut dude. He's a guy who wants all the information. Give me everything you got. I'm gonna read it. I'm gonna know stuff, and then I'm gonna make my call, and I'm gonna live with the consequences. And he really is going to be all right with the consequences no matter what.
Switching just briefly from Madden, I want to talk about Theo. It's been talked about for quite a while that he is on his last year of his deal, and he and Ricketts kind of toss it off to the side anytime it's brought up. But I've got another theory, and that is that if the Cubs win the World Series this year, Theo is not back with the organization next year because he has accomplished his goal and leaves it in good hands with Jed Hoyer and Jason McLeod. Do you buy that, or do you think that he's going to be back?
You know, I haven't given it a ton of thought, because every time I've talked with him on air, or then, you know, at a break or something like that, I've really got the feeling that they're here until it gets done. But you bring up the possibility of it getting done. So I don't know. I wish I had more insight to give you. I will say this, that the decision to go ahead and get Chapman and let the public perception be sullied a little bit, as he knew it would be, it's a lot bolder and earlier than it needed to be to do that kind of public relations thing, don't you think?
Yeah.
And I don't think if this was Boston, where he had the emotional connection, you know, there's a lot of people who won't necessarily like to hear this, but the truth is the truth. He grew up in Brookline and dreamt of being a Red Sox player, then manager, et cetera. I don't think he would have done it that soon. It was the first real bad apple they happily brought in, or not even bad apple, somebody with a past that the public would... Julio Lugo, and that's what, 2007?
Yeah.
Something like that. So that has struck me a little bit. There's sort of a lack of an emotional connection in that way, which means that, I don't know, I guess your theory could be plausible. But I don't know, he seems to love it. I'm not sure what else he would do, whether it be to go to another sport. And, you know, I guess my gut answer would still be no, it that would not happen. If they won, he would still stick around and sign another deal. But you may prove right.
Hey, listen, Joel, Matt.
Yeah,
I just want to say, well, you know, I appreciate you taking some time tonight. I do want to go check out Wilco and, you know, check out Octopus Arm Glenn Cochi on the drums there. And, you know, I would love to have a podcast with you just talking about the replacements and Wilco and such. But we'll have to do that another time. But in the meantime, so we'll let you go with this question. I want to know, gun to your head, how does this season end?
How does this year's scene end?
Yeah. How does the season end?
God, I think they win it. I think they win
it. I do too.
I think they win it because Madden has every bullpen tool he could possibly have. And I think once they get there to the games that matter, if he needs Chapman for five outs, he'll use him for five outs. I think that if he needs Chapman in the seventh, against Murphy and Harper, he's going to have had that conversation leading up to that series with Chapman. I really do, I think he's just gonna, you know, he's gonna do absolutely everything that he can. And then, you know, the fact that I don't think they're going to get dominated by aces to the level that they did last year, because look, Zobrist is there. Look at Bryant's strikeout rate, how down it is. Look at his contact rate, how far up it is, right? I think even with Hayward's struggles, I think they've got enough guys who get the message and will move the baseball, as Joe says. We all know it's a crapshoot, but I just think they're as armed as any 25-man roster I could conceive of in this era of baseball.
Well, Matt, thank you again. Really great talking to you. Thanks for sitting in and being our Carlos this week.
You got it. And tell Carlos. Yeah, well, tell Carlos he's got to be in tomorrow morning for me at like what 8:45.
That's a fair trade.
Yeah, we can take over at 9 and deal with Goff, and we're all gonna be okay.
Thanks so much, Matt. We appreciate
it. Thanks, guys. Anytime.
Thank you.
Cool. See
ya. Wow, that was really great stuff from Matt. That was. Wow, he brought us some really good stuff to think about.
What did you think of him saying that this clubhouse was Ross and Lester's?
That surprised me a little bit, but I can see what he means. I definitely understand. Like it wasn't something that I just heard and was like, I can't believe that. I totally get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting is that I see some parallels between Ross and Madden is that they're kind of funny, colorful guys and interesting and good to talk to, but they also are pretty hardline too when it comes to certain things. And I think of when Madden benched Castro last year and he said, you know, I told him this is not a temporary thing. And there was just like a certain firmness to it that just made me think that, he knows what he's doing. He's not messing around, and he's not kind of a Mike Quadi, kind of letting the players run all over him. And so I was a little surprised, but I just that was great insight, definitely.
All right,
yeah,
so
I'm not gonna lie. It actually, I don't want to say it scared me, but it startled me a little bit to think about how quickly those two guys came in and took over the clubhouse. And I don't really mean that in a bad way. It's just interesting. And then you kind of realize that was the intent behind the signing more than anything is, hey, let's get two kind of salty veterans to come in here and teach up all these kids. But it is really interesting to hear him say Rizzo is Ross's boy. And that just gives you an idea that 2, 3, 4 years down the road that this is going to be Anthony Rizzo's team, if it isn't already in some senses. But I thought that was a really interesting take.
So do you imagine that they're going to have beer and chicken in the clubhouse?
Oh, I like chicken. I don't know.
Yeah, I like beer. All right, so kind of moving forward into some of the other stuff we plan to talk about. Joel, you brought up an idea, and that was to talk about who we want to see more of down the stretch. Do you want to go ahead and take it away with your pick for that?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't my point. Maybe I miscommunicated. It wasn't necessarily who we want to see more of, just like who we hope really kind of shows us what they've got in the stretch and really becomes a key player. And it's funny because I've thought about it and I my head says Hamill or, you know, of course you want Jason Hayward to come around and maybe Zobrist to come back too. But the funny thing is the player in my heart, the person who just comes up as soon as I think of this topic is Javier Baez. And I don't know why, but I just feel like, you know, he's got so many tools and we saw the out of control throw home, the other night against the Rockies. And we see the bad, but we see the good too with the power and the arm. And I just want to see him it's going to be a lot to ask him to harness it over the next, several weeks. But I just feel like if he can step it up just a little bit, he will bring them such a dimension that I feel like he just gives them, he takes them to the next level if he can kind of just be who he is a little more, if that makes sense. And so that's who I want to see kind of step it up a little bit more in the next couple of weeks.
I think that's a good one, and I will actually take his counterpart sort of from a prospect status. Everyone seemed to lump them together in the offseason, especially Jorge Soler. I just feel like
that's
this guy
call.
Is constantly dealing with truncated seasons and times when he can't put together, you know, 3, 4, 5 consecutive months of being on the field to get hot. And we saw what he was capable of last fall in September and October in the playoffs. And what he was the Cubs' best hitter in the playoffs. So for a couple of reasons, obviously I want the Cubs to do well and I want Soler to be a big part of that. But if he can come out and have a huge September, October again, and really on a national stage turn a lot of heads, I think that really elevates his trade value back to where it was last year and maybe, you know, even before that when he had prospect status. So I think that he is the piece that the Cubs are still looking to move for controllable starting pitching, as we always talk about. And I think another hot October would really go a long ways into the player he could possibly return and trade this offseason. It's a premature conversation, but I would love to see it for both of those reasons.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we don't have to spend too much time on this, but we've heard them talk about, you know, Javier Baez when people like Matt said,
I'm just pulling up real quick,
should try to trade him, and you know, everyone was saying, oh, we should trade Schwarber, and the front office was always like, nope, not going to happen, not going to do it. You haven't heard a peep about that about Soler. And so my point is that I agree. I think that he probably gets moved in the offseason because there are too many bodies in the outfield. And if he can put something together, A, that's great for the team, and B, I think it's trade value. I think that's going to come into play for sure.
Isaac, you make a really good point about being able to trade him for starting pitching, but we talk about Baez and how he's improved on his strikeouts. I think Soler has too. I'm just kind of pulling up the splits. If you take out like the first, it's only the set for 7 games of this season. His numbers are really ridiculous. Let's see what it says here. He's taking out the first 7 games. It's .257 batting average, .347 on base, .459 slugging. It's an .807 OPS with 8 home runs in only 170 plate appearances. But in 170 plate appearances, he only struck out 41 times. So the strikeout rate, which was like 30% before, is quite a bit down. This is a lot of improvement for a guy. I mean, those aren't the numbers that you were expecting out of this guy when he came up as a prospect. But there's been a lot of improvement here. And the other big number that I'm seeing, his BABIP is down at 300. Whereas it took him hitting near .370 for a BABIP to sustain the kind of numbers he had before. So there's a lot of positive signs here for this guy, and I'm going with the same with you, Isaac. That's the guy that I want to see more of down the stretch.
It's really interesting that you bring up his strikeout rate, because I've been thinking about that a lot for various players on this Cubs team recently. Solaris is interesting because he hasn't had all that much time. So if that's a true correction, then to your point about the BABIP, which he hits the ball so hard, I don't think his BABIP's generally going to be that low. It's very encouraging for him. But one of the biggest stories of this entire year from my perspective, and it's going very underreported, is the fact that Chris Bryant's strikeout rate has gone from 31% last year to below 23%, just barely below 23% this year, 22%. If Chris Bryant, with the power that he has, strikes out at a 22% clip or less, if that's a real improvement because of his swing plane changes and everything else, some approach changes as well, you're looking at a guy that is going to be a perennial MVP because his power is unmatched. It's unrequited in the game, I think. And the 22% rate is a shocking figure to me. And I realize there may be some, maybe some of the older generation that listens to this that says, well, it's still too high. Maybe that is, but 22% for a power hitter in this day and age is quite low. So that's a huge step forward for Chris Bryant. That's part of why you're seeing the ascension to MVP status immediately that you are. And I think it is just an incredibly telling thing for his future. I also don't know if you guys caught that his 57 home runs are the most in history for the first two years of any Cub of all time. Did you guys see that today?
No, I didn't.
So he broke a franchise record already.
More to come.
Well, it's not the highest bar, unfortunately. But yeah, no,
thanks, Joel. Thanks.
Just pull it down a little bit. Jeez. But that said, no, I think we are. I don't know if generational talent is, maybe that's overstating a little bit, but I think between his, defense and his base running and his just overall demeanor and obviously his power, I think you're looking at a phenomenal player.
You say you might be overstating it, that he's a generational player. I would go on record and make a bet right now that Chris Bryant will be the greatest Cub of all time if he plays his whole career here. I think he will be the greatest.
8:43 p.m.
Yep. I think he's going to probably approach home run records. I think he's going to pass warp totals. I think he's going to be an icon from a personality, a look standpoint. I think he will go down as the greatest Cub of all time by the time this is over.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I maybe not go that far for a guy who's in his second season, but I don't put that out of the realm of possibility. I think
that's why it's a hot take, Ryan. That's why.
Yeah.
Mike Fontenot might have something to say about that.
But...
There's still time. I generally think that assuming no bad things and that Bryant is here for at least 7 full seasons with the Cubs, I think you're going to see him as near the top in a lot of categories on the Cubs all-time lists. The next thing I wanted to bring up, and I know we've talked, this may be getting out the stick and beating the horse to death at this point, but I saw in our Slack chat, I was falling asleep in my basement when John Lester was pitching in his last start with the Cubs, which he ended up throwing 118 pitches. In our Slack chat, I saw blowing up Joel and Isaac mentioning the amount of pitches that Lester threw. It doesn't bother me. It just simply, in this instance, it does not bother me. But I am interested to hear from both of you why it was such a big deal to you.
Well, I don't know why it wouldn't be a big deal, is I guess what I would retort with that. Last year, we saw Jake Arrieta wear down the stretch. At the beginning of the year, we saw a period of dead arm for John Lester. We just saw John Lackey go on the DL with a tired shoulder, sore shoulder. I would call it a tired shoulder at this stage. So why isn't it a big deal? Why aren't the Cubs and Joe Maddon protecting their biggest investment and their most important pieces for the playoffs? Why aren't they protecting them with kid gloves? These games, somebody mentioned it earlier, that these games are basically meaningless, and that's why we're trying out bullpen guys. Then why is our $155 million investment out there throwing 119 pitches on a hot night? I can't begin to rationalize why that would happen. I've definitely said my piece here, and Joe Ben doesn't agree with me, and I kind of leave it at that.
All right, so do you want me to walk you through my rationale on this?
Sure.
All right, so I'm going to ask you this question. 118 pitches, is that something that you think, if Joe Maddon needs that out of John Lester in a clinching game of a series in October, are you okay with it then?
Yeah, I am. 119, I think, is what he threw. And yes, then I am okay with it.
Okay. Do you think he needs to be able to throw that at least on occasion during the regular season to be able to feel good about doing it in the postseason?
No, I don't. Not a guy with as much experience as Lester. I don't think that he needs to.
So you legitimately do not believe that to expect a guy to get up near 120 in the postseason, that he shouldn't do it at all during the regular season?
I think it depends on the player. For a guy with less experience and less postseason experience, perhaps. But a guy like Lester that has shown that he can do that when the time comes, no, I don't think there's going to be any mental hurdle for him to climb over. I don't think there's anything physical there. I think that his odds increase being able to do it in the postseason if he hasn't done it as much in the regular season and he's not as tired. I mean, these mileage is a thing on your arm, and I think that all this does is increase the mileage on his arm and decreases his ability to do it later in the year.
All right, so, and I know, Joel, you want to jump in here. I'm kind of still walking through my point. To me, I see it like a reliever stretching out. You wouldn't expect a reliever to throw 70 pitches if he's hasn't thrown more than 50 in the season, right? So how could you expect John Lester to throw 120 in the postseason if you're cutting him off at 105 every start? And it's the same thing for me. If you're expecting him to go those 10, 15 extra pitches into a game, you have to at least let him do it every once in a while.
But to that point, for a reliever that's used to throwing 15 pitches...
I said 50.
Yeah, but I'm saying normally a guy that would throw 15.
Okay.
And then asking him to stretch out and throw 70, you're quadrupling his workload.
But I didn't say 15, I said 50.
Okay, so you're talking like a middle reliever and then stretching him out.
Yeah, like if a guy's, if he tosses two or three innings for you, and then like they did with Mike Montgomery, they cut him off at 60 pitches. He wasn't ready to go further than that. The greater point here, since July, John Lester's pitch counts 56, 64, 98, 100, 95, 107, 91, 118. I don't see any problem with him doing it once out of every 2 months. Why is that a problem for anybody? If you're telling me John Lester's going out there throwing 115, 113, 118, 110, then yeah, I agree with your greater point. But these are big boys, you know? Like, let them go 118 every once in a while when you really feel like you need it and you need to save your pen, and that's going to help him be confident in doing it and going into October and doing it.
Joel?
Yeah, well, this is fascinating because I see I came in here siding with Isaac, but Ryan, I think you're making some really good points there.
Boom.
But my point...
I think you're terrible, but that's okay.
But my point would be kind of along what Isaac said, like, then how do you get them rest? I mean, you know, the point stands that Arrieta agreed that he was gassed at the end of the season. We saw that in the playoffs. You know, he obviously had the good game against Pittsburgh, but against the Mets, you know, and, you know, the Cardinals, to a certain extent, he was not what we had hoped. So I can see the point about you need to stretch them out to kind of let them hit their upper limit occasionally, but at the same time, you know, I'm looking at the Cubs' numbers of starting innings pitched this season, and they're second in the major leagues right behind the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays have 767 innings pitched from their starters. The Cubs have 755 innings pitched from their starters. So if it were kind of, I mean, I see your point.
That is, though?
Well, because they're good and they're pitching well.
Yeah, I mean, but, like, you're going to have more innings pitched from your starting.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, yeah. When you're throwing, you know, quality starts every single time.
No, if you're looking at
innings, you know, probably the teams with the least innings pitch are the guys with a terrible pitching.
The crappiest pitchers, right. No, yeah. I get that. And that, certainly their quality is certainly part of it. But at the same time, I mean, that was the whole point. You know, we heard before the season that was why, you know, that was one of the big reasons they got Adam Warren, that he was going to do some spot starting. And Travis Wood and, you know, Montgomery and Trevor Cahill, like these guys were like, you know, they were going to do the occasional spot start to kind of give Arrieta and Lester some breathing room, and we've seen that recently, but we haven't seen it as much as I would have thought. And I thought we just haven't seen the stars getting as much rest as I would have thought. So I see your point about giving, you know, Lester some, you know, letting him hit 118, 120 to keep his arm, you know, at that level. But at the same time, I think you do need to just kind of make sure that he has enough room to rest.
Yeah, and I, to your point, if you're right about the fact that there is a certain stretching out mentality, hey, he needs to be able to know he can do this, which I'll come in on the other side of that and disagree with it. But if you're right about that, I'll allow you that. I will still err on the side of, I would rather them be rested and not be ready to throw 120 pitches. I would rather them be ready to throw 105, to your point, in the playoffs and be rested and ready to give me 105 than I would having them be borderline tired and be, end quote, ready to throw 120. And that's where I'm always going to land, is those guys need to be able to go out there and give you 7. They don't necessarily need to be able to go out there and give you 9, especially considering the bullpen moves and some of the future that has been sacrificed for the bullpen that these guys have put together. So that's essentially my final point, is I just want those 4 starters to be as rested as they possibly can be in October.
Well, it's funny that you say that you just want him to give you 7. You don't need him to go out and give you 9. The 118 pitches was in 6 2/3 innings,
which made me even more mad, I think.
Well, I mean, it was because I can't remember exactly what the situation was, but I know they were coming off of extra innings and using a bullpen really bad, and I feel like in that game you had Montgomery and Cahill and Chapman not available, essentially, and possibly Rondon too, now that we can look back on it. So yeah. I think that was a game where Madden absolutely needed Lester and he built up his pitch count early on, and he probably went to him and said, today's the day. You went 91 last time, and you've only gone over 100, twice in your last seven starts, so today's the day you're going to stretch out and give me a little bit more.
Yeah, Patton, I think, was the one guy that was out there that was definitely available. His two really short outings that you mentioned, those were both his stinkers right after the break, right?
Three innings with five runs, one and a third with eight earned, 56 and 64 pitches, the 98, 100, 95, 107, 91. So, to the greater point, 118 every once in a while. I'm looking here. There's only one other time that he's been over 110 this season. He's been generally right around 100. I don't see why that's gonna wear him out personally.
Can we officially say that the poor stallion is dead? The horse has been beat to its death.
Yes.
Yeah. I think this is a good conversation, but maybe this and Hayward, like, we just, like, okay, put it on the shelf and probably let it just sit there for the rest of the season.
Joel, we've got 20 more minutes for you to tell us what you think about Hayward's ground balls to second base.
4-3.
Hey, I'm just going to let it go, breathe in, breathe out, Montana sky, doesn't bother me anymore. You know, this is the new me. It's all zen here.
All right. Did we have anything else we wanted to do before we go into 60 seconds with a former Cub?
So, yeah, actually, I was in Iowa this week covering the iCubs this weekend, and Bijan Rademacher was kind enough to give me about 15 minutes in a one-on-one interview to discuss his ascension as a prospect. And he told me some really great things, which I'm going to write up. But one of those is that he was actually more highly touted as a pitching prospect than he was as an offensive positional player. So he told me that the reason that he switched and didn't want to be scouted as a pitcher is because there was too much pressure on him, and he couldn't live with himself if he blew a game or blew a save or something of that nature. So that was pretty interesting. And then some of the other things that he told me that were interesting were he never struggled with velocity at any point in his life until Double-A, and that's when he said that he felt like his long swing got exposed and he needed to shorten up his load and his high leg kick and everything to get shorter of the ball to deal with the velocity in Double-A. And he said in the first 2 weeks the things that had stuck out to him in Triple-A were that the off-speed stuff was so much more refined in Triple-A, and he felt like he had seen more off-speed stuff combined in 2 weeks in Triple-A than he had seen in his whole season before that in Double-A. So a ton of thanks to Rademacher for spending the time that he did with me. And this is a guy that he likened himself to Matt Caesar. You'll like that, Joel. But he really felt like he could play a role for this team in the future, and that his bat was good enough to contribute. I also asked him if Anthony Rizzo could maybe teach him a thing or two about hitting off lefties, as Bijan had kind of intimated to me that was an issue that he'd had. And he kind of laughed and said, well, he wished he was 6'3 and, 250 pounds or whatever Rizzo is, but he couldn't quite maybe correlate himself with Rizzo because the ball just came off their bat so much differently. So it was an interesting moment of introspection from a guy that is climbing the ladder for the Cubs right now.
It's interesting. I always appreciate talking to guys, and you can kind of tell when you hear them interviewed. Like, I heard Chris Coughlin interviewed. When I first heard him talking, I didn't know who it was, and I thought it was a coach. And then I thought it was some. He sounded just so thoughtful and really, like, spiritual. And I was like, wow, this guy's really introspective. And it was Coughlin. And then so it's interesting to hear you talk about him in those terms. But I'm curious, so if you let's play armchair scout for a second, what do you see his ceiling, and do you see him with the Cubs in 3 years?
I think that his ceiling is actually very similar to what you're seeing from Caesar. He's the one who brought that up, and I thought it was really good. Obviously, you're talking left-handed and right-handed, but this is a guy with really good speed. He has above average speed. He said himself that his best aspect, he thought, as a prospect was his bat-to-ball ability, more so than even his approach. He's always had solid walk rates and on-base percentages in the minors, but his approach is secondary to his bat-to-ball skills. So I found that interesting. I would say his ceiling is probably as a fourth outfielder, but possibly a good fourth outfielder. I could see him getting some starts somewhere down the line, probably not for this organization if he's getting starts, but somewhere down the line. And I don't limit him. what I learned from him this week was that he's a very cerebral young man, and that he believes that his work ethic will take him to the next level, and I won't doubt him for one second. So I would say that fourth outfielder is something that is definitely attainable for him, and from there it's what he can do with the bat that will carry him. So we'll see.
Interesting.
Cool stuff. Joel, do you have a 60 seconds with a former Cub?
I do indeed. I have to say I spent quite a bit of time trying to winnow this down, so it might be like 67 seconds with a former Cub or so.
If you can stretch that two more seconds, that'd be pretty nice.
That would be nice. I was wondering, should I go there? And I thought, no, I'll just throw it out there at 67 and see what happens. So you did not disappoint me. Oh, and anyway, this
a little bit.
This week is Ryan Therio. Therio.
All right, are you ready?
I am.
Go.
Short, white, semi-athletic Cubs fans rejoiced when Ryan Stewart Therio joined the team in 2005. For lo, here was their godhead. The diminutive infielder may have stood only 5'11 at the plate, but he was huge in the heart of this particular group of fans, who even gave him a sobriquet, the Riot. And the wee infielder repaid their love by giving the Cubs a few decent years, culminating in 2008 when he batted a 307 and posted an on-base percentage of .387. He was described with words often beginning with a G: gritty, gutty, a gamer. But then slowly other G words took over, as in not going to get on base or can't get to the ball because my range is so limited. And then in 2010, he was the last G word, gone. But he did not go quietly. Therio eventually joined the hated St. Louis Cardinals and said the cruelest words of all: I'm finally on the right side of the rivalry. How could he say this? How could he twist the knife so callously? Infuriatingly, he was proven right when the Cardinals won the World Series, beating the Texas Rangers 4-3. He may have gone 0-14 in the series, but he still got a ring, which will make it all the more joyous when the Cubs win this year, and we can look back on the Lilliputian Therio and just grin.
Ugh. Yeah.
I need to go take a shower now.
Yeah, it makes me feel good that the days of Ryan Therio are gone.
Isn't it funny, like the love that he got? It was who? I'm blanking on the guy who was traded for Chris Archer.
Garza? People loved
it. No,
the Cubs traded him.
Mark DeRosa. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same thing. The same kind of love. Although DeRosa was, had a little more
actually like a productive player.
Yeah.
And he was likable at least.
Right. Yeah. I was okay with Therio until he said that I'm on the right side of the. The rivalry thing, and that was crazy.
The end. That was the end.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And he's on Twitter and occasionally lashes out against people who look at the game with an analytical point of view. So, yeah, he's everything you expect him to be, I think.
That's no surprise.
All right, so this week's question of the week comes from somebody who just describes themselves as Ryan's secret stash. I don't know what that's all about, but yeah. And the question is, how do we see the playoff roster shaking out? And I kind of did a scribble on a post-it note. I wrote down everyone that I believe has a spot on the roster pretty much locked at this point. And I came out with 18. Wilson Contreras, Rizzo, Zobrist, Russell, Bryant, Soler, Fowler, Hayward, Javi, David Ross, Lackey, Lester, Arrieta, Hendricks, Chapman, Strope, Rondon, and Justin Grimm.
That's I'm not so sure about that Bryant guy. I think he's on the bubble.
Yeah, you never know. That's 18. How do we see the last 7 spots coming up? And I'll tell you, I've got 7 pitchers listed already. So who do you guys think is absolutely on the roster that I didn't mention?
I didn't write them down as I went, so I'm going to take a slightly different approach to this. To me, the most interesting discussion as far as a playoff roster is surrounding Miguel Montero, and I don't think you didn't mention him. Is that correct?
I did not.
Okay, and I think that there's wildly differing opinions on, in the baseball blogosphere as to his value, not only to the clubhouse, which I think he definitely has value there, but also on the field. So, Joel, is Miguel Montero going to be on this playoff roster?
Wow, I noticed that Ryan didn't mention him. I'm going to say no.
I'll tell you the moment I started questioning it is when I saw Wilson Contreras scheduled to catch Jake Arrieta.
Yeah.
That was the moment that I questioned whether he would actually be left off the roster.
He had a nice game the other day with a couple hits, yeah. But I think it's too little too late. And I think
it was hit him where they ain't game. I mean, that's all it was.
And his defense is just, I mean, his arm is just gone, you know? I mean, maybe higher, but I just don't see it happening.
So if you are buying into Warp right now, then you're buying into Miguel Montero's defense as his pitch framing usurping and trumping his inability to move and his inability to throw. So by saying his defense isn't good enough and you don't think he'll be on the roster, I take it that you're not buying his advanced stats enough to say he should be on the roster because of this. Is that true?
Yes. I would say that I'm aware we've discussed framing ad nauseum, and I'm aware of his, you know, the savoir faire he brings behind the plate, and I just feel like, you know, that is, you're talking about moving the dial just by micrometers, whereas Wilson Contreras can be a game changer. So I just don't see it happening.
How is it possible that you both bring all of the class and just, you know, highbrow vernacular to this podcast, yet you also bring us Pete Lecoq? How do those two things exist in the same dimension?
That's the beautiful dichotomy of life, isn't it?
I guess.
All right, I want to go one more route on this question. I listed off Chapman, Strope, Rondon, and Justin Grimm. Do we think that, first of all, seven, is that how many you think they'll keep in the bullpen for the postseason? You think eight?
I think eight, and Travis Wood to me is a shoe in there if you didn't mention him. Travis.
Yeah, I didn't just because we Joel and I had kind of discussed that. So let's say eight. Who are your other four in the pen, and is Jason Hamill one of them?
Wow, after today. So Travis Wood's in there for me. I think Mike Montgomery has showed enough that he needs to be on the playoff roster, so that would be two. Joe Smith's not going to be anywhere near it, I don't believe.
Fire him out of a cannon.
I think Jason Hamill will be on this playoff roster.
I think he has to be.
I think he has to be too, as well.
Because which that's is why a valuable I thought, asset if you know, something goes down.
That's why I was thinking seven, is because if you're bringing Hamill, that's like having two relief pitchers, because that guy can go out and give you four innings if you need him to.
The other guy that's going to be on there is Trevor Cahill. So I think it's Hamill, Cahill, Wood, and Montgomery from the guys you didn't name. I think
so.
That's great.
No Edwards, huh?
That's tough.
We have not seen a lot out of Travis Wood. I know his splits is against lefties is strong, but to me, he's much more on the bubble than you guys have described. I really wonder if he's – I feel like Madden is putting him in to kind of give him his audition, and the last couple nights he's not – he's, you know, they'd be hitting the gong on the gong show. And that's a little bit before you guys' time. Maybe on The Voice they wouldn't turn around their chairs. Maybe that's more up your alley. But I just – I don't know. Travis Wood, to my mind, is on the bubble.
Yeah, interesting. We see that totally differently.
I think he's on the bubble too. Although I will say, when I look at it, the meta perspective of placing pitchers on this team on or off the playoff roster, it's very difficult to see Joe Maddon going to Travis Wood the way he's used him over the last 2 years and even just this season, and say you're not on the playoff roster. Considering he puts him in for one battery, puts him in for an inning and a half, he uses him as setup, he uses him as long relief. I mean, he puts him in left field. He pinch hits with him.
Yeah.
So it's hard to imagine him not putting him on the roster.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And to the great – what, Joel, you just said, as a loogie, he's been great. A 536 OPS against left-handers, 156 batting average and 90 at-bats. I mean, that's those are good numbers. He's only allowed two home runs and 90 at-bats to lefties. Right-handers, on the other hand, 895 OPS against Wood.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have to assume if he's going to make the postseason, he's only coming in, like we kind of talked about earlier, if you've got Daniel Murphy and Bryce Harper coming up, Wood's going to come in. if Dusty Baker, you know, actually figures out not to bat them together in a lineup, maybe you put Wood out in left field for an out and then bring him back in to get the other one. But yeah, it's very interesting. I tend to think that there's going to be somebody with a major case to be on this postseason roster who gets left off. As much as I think Trevor Cahill's been great in his semi-starting role, I don't see him in a relief role on this roster, given what we know about Carl Edwards and how well Mike Montgomery's pitched. I just see either Montgomery or Cahill is going to be left out.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
So for Edwards,
coming down between those guys.
So if you're leaving Cahill, and I can buy that. So if you're leaving Cahill off, you're bringing Edwards on as your eighth. So you know, this is also assuming health, which unfortunately we've seen several guys kind of borderline hurt.
I penciled in Strope just because we have to assume.
And Rondon, but I think Wood's going to be there, and I think Wood is the Lug. I think you're right.
Yeah, it sounds like Strope actually is probably a lot closer to coming back than we may have thought originally too. I heard Coomer talking about his surgery the other day and how the tear was somewhat easy for the doctors to get to, so they didn't have to fish around in his knee to get to it. So that means that he could be, you know, much quicker on the return. So we might be seeing Strope in just a couple weeks, which is really cool.
Man, there's been all sorts of consternation on the internet about this team's bullpen recently, and I am so far from being concerned about them because I think this is one of the stronger bullpens in the game, if healthy, and there's time to get healthy here. I think that the bullpen is a strength and a noted strength, so
I feel the good first about question, it. Yeah, the first question we asked Matt, and he seemed to kind of confirm, look, Madden abused Rondon, Strope, and Wood last year in the final 2 months of the season to ensure a playoff spot. He knew exactly who his best relievers were, and he went to him when he needed the outs. This year, it's been mostly a 12 or 13 game lead for the last few weeks in the division. The Cubs are at this point in no real, you know, they're not scared of losing the division. They know where they are in the standings, and they know where they're going to finish. They're a confident team. They know what they're going to do. So why wouldn't Joe Maddon bring in Joe Smith to see, can this guy get a high leverage out? Why wouldn't he bring in Carl Edwards to face Albert Pujols and Mike Trout with two on and nobody out? I mean, what does he have to lose if Carl Edwards gives up, you know, walks three people and gives up a home run? All he loses is one game, and he learns a whole lot about his pitcher.
Mm-hmm. It's been fun also this weekend to see Rob Zastrzynski come in and get some outs in Coors. So he is a great guy, just one of the great guys in baseball. So it was really fun to see him make his debut finally and get some outs this weekend.
Yeah, I didn't get to talk to him at all in Iowa, but I did get to see him heading to the buffet. So he looked good from where I was.
Yeah, nice guy for sure. Good stuff. I think that's a good bullpen discussion. It'll be interesting. And to your point, there will be one or two names there that I think everybody will cringe, knowing how much they've meant to the team over the last 1 or 2 years. Cringe not seeing them on the roster, whether it's Cahill or whoever it may be.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we beat that horse to death.
A lot of dead horses in our wake tonight.
We are killing horses left and right.
No animals were actually injured in the production of this podcast.
Isaac, do you have a at-bat of the week?
I do, and actually this week it is the at-bats of the week, and this goes out to the sparkly-eyed Chris Bryant, who on Thursday – did I just hear you gasp, Joel?
No, it was something in my throat.
That's not your throat. But on Thursday, for the second time this year, he collected a perfect 5-for-5 night. He had 4 runs, 5 RBIs, 2 home runs, a double, and 2 singles. So Bryant has done a lot of things this year, but collecting his second 5-for-5, it was deja vu all over again, and I felt like the at-bat of the week needed to go to all 5 of them for Mr. Bryant yet again, and all of the joy that he has brought us and his ability and his looks and everything else that he has done on the field this year. So your at-bat of the week is Chris Bryant on Thursday in a 9-6 win, going 5-for-5 with 2 home runs and 5 RBIs.
Awesome.
Yep, cool.
You added that whole thing, and Joel and I have just no response.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think that's something we would have talked with Matt about had we, you know, had time. Is the whole MVP thing, and that's a can of worms we probably don't want to get into. Maybe it makes itself a little more clear by next week. But I think the whole MVP thing is pretty interesting.
Yeah, the fun thing about the MVP discussion is a week ago I was like, totally Rizzo. Yep, Rizzo's got this. I ignore the warp. I understand the warp numbers, but Rizzo, for all these reasons, is the MVP. And now a week later, I'm like, yep, totally Bryant. Bryant's got this.
Yeah.
Totally. So it was like 2 days for me. I was on with Boers and Bernstein, and I said that. I said Rizzo, and it kind of surprised him. And 2 days later, I'm like, oh, crap, it's definitely Bryant now. It is definitely Bryant. It was so fast that happened.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those things where I think it's going to come down to the last week of the season. We're going to be discussing who is the MVP.
Did you see, I don't know if you guys happened to see what I tweeted earlier today, though, that since July 27th, Bryant is hitting like 355 and his on base is 480 or something like that. For like almost 2 months now, he's been putting up those numbers.
Crazy.
Yeah, they're just insane.
And some guys out there yelling at Evan Altman for not talking about how bad Bryant's been since the All-Star break.
Was that the one where they accused Isaac, and rightly so, of being a racist for saying that Chris Bryant was better than Jason Hayward?
I think they actually accused Evan of it, and I just kind of defended Evan. I was like, well, here's two stats, and then like in bold, racist. I'm like,
you are racist. Yeah.
Have you heard me talk about Mr. Russell by any chance?
Isaac in that conversation was the epitome of the Simpsons gif of Grandpa Simpson walking in, hanging up his hat, doing the spin, grabbing his hat, walking out.
Rolling right back out when I saw what was going on.
that was to me, that was like the classic Twitter exchange.
Oh, Lord.
I love
so
it.
So bad, so bad.
Yeah. Well, and on that note, thank you to Matt Spiegel yet again for joining us. If we could have him every week, we'd fire Carlos right now. And Carlos, I hope you're getting up nice and early to make sure that you're on with Goff tomorrow.
Good stuff, guys. We'll see you later.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks.